Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Time for This Week in Chicago History with Anna DeVlantis. Anna, good morning. I was reading the front page of the Trib today about the Illinois Central train that collided with the train behind it. October 30th, 1972, 45 died, 300 injured. And September 29th of 1982, another date for a Chicago tragedy. Tell us about this.
Yeah, somber anniversary. Another one, Bob, you're right. And really a scary time. Most people will recall, if you were here in 1982, it's the 40-year anniversary of the Tylenol murders. Just remember the panic that ensued, you know, in this area at that time. It all started the morning of September 29th. As you point out, Bob, an Elk Grove father called 911 reporting that his seventh grade daughter had collapsed on the bathroom floor after taking Tylenol. They thought it was an allergic reaction. Later that day, an Arlington Heights man collapsed and died after taking Tylenol. His brother, his sister-in-law, died the next day after taking pills from the same bottle. At that point, detectives knew this was a homicide investigation, and the Tylenol contained cyanide. The packages had been tampered with. And you might have also seen the news. I think the Daily Herald had a story this week about how they've reopened this case. It's a cold case, saying there's some new information. They're not revealing what, but that they are looking into some new information that they think might maybe help them find the person or persons behind this. They may soon also be re-interviewing James Lewis, Bob. Remember the 76-year-old guy? He served 10 years for extortion. He wrote that extortion note, pretty detailed one, too, demanding $1 million to stop the killing. He has been a prime suspect in the case. We pulled a clip from his jailhouse interview, one he did with ABC 7 years ago.
Tylenol murder is still out dancing in the streets of this country, and the prosecutors in Chicago could care less.
Well, the prosecutors in Chicago think that he's not dancing, that he's here in Oklahoma behind bars.
Well, every time they make statements like that, they're blowing big wet kisses to that Tylenol murderer.
It's still an open case, isn't it?
Yeah, open case. But I mean, I went back and looked at that letter he wrote, Bob. It was made public. Remember, he talked about how easy it was to kill someone with cyanide. He laid out how much cyanide you'd need. He said it only takes him 10 minutes per bottle to put it in there, and he's only spent $50. So all you got to do is wire me $1 million or send me $1 million and I'll stop it. But he has maintained his innocence. So we'll see where that goes.
Yeah, guilty of only extortion. Yep. I tell you, every time you open up a container of medicine, you think about that case. In 1971, the Bears were in a new home, weren't they?
Soldier Field. They played the first game this week on their new turf. Still their home, at least for now. But remember they played, Bob, you'll know this, a half a century at Wrigley Field. And they had entertained so many different fields over the years of where they were going to go. 1970, they actually opened the season at Dyke Stadium at Northwestern's campus and signed a five-year deal with NU, thinking that was going to be their future home, at least for a little while. But the Big Ten nixed that.
I thought it was Dave Bennett that nixed that.
No. I've seen the NFL films of that game. They were playing the Philadelphia Eagles, I remember, at old Dyke Stadium. And it just, it's really too bad. It would have been a nice piece of history for them to play there a little longer.
Yeah. You think that would have worked, Dave? I don't know.
Well, I don't know that the city of Evanston was all in favor of that, quite frankly.
You have a clip. This is from the first game at Soldier Field?
Very first one. You and Dave will appreciate this. Very first game, and one Dick Butkus is front and center in this particular play we pulled.
With a new hat and new hopes, Chicago's Jim Dooley brought the Bears to their new home, Soldier Field, to face the Pittsburgh Steelers. With Gale Sayers not fully recovered from an injury, and with an unproven offense, Chicago's only star is number 51, Dick Butkus. After his first quarter interception was wiped out by a penalty, Butkus's pose expressed the futility that has characterized the Bears in recent years. But like a true all-pro, Butkus refused to give up. On the very next play, he picked off another pass. Butkus is valuable to Chicago, not only for his own defensive genius, but because he serves as an inspiration.
Good old number 51.
By the way, he took over the Bears' Twitter feed last night.
I heard about that.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. But
How does he know how to operate Twitter?
Oh, he's on Twitter. He's on Twitter. I know. It seems...
I have to follow him.
Yeah, but the other thing, that voice on that, narrating that, I think, Bob, you might back me up on this, Tom Brookshire. That sounds like him.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah, it could be. Named from the past. Bears won, by the way, didn't they, Anna?
They pulled it out for a victory with one Dick Butkus there. You do need to follow him on Twitter. He's a great follower.
He is.
He's awesome.
I'm on it. And the first marathon in Chicago, is this right, 1905?
1905, it wasn't called the Chicago Marathon then. Chicago just hosted one. 15 runners showed up to run it. 7 crossed the finish line. That one started in Evanston and made its way to Washington Park. It is interesting, though, to go back and look at the archives on this one, too, Bob, because they ran through gravel, unpaved roads. Michigan Avenue was cobblestone back then. You know, they didn't have the high-performance running shoes. Think about how that was. Yeah. They actually had to stop for a train at Devon Avenue. And then the bridge lifted on downtown, so they gave them credit for the time that they stopped. But that was the humble beginnings of the Chicago Marathon, which is coming up, by the way, October 9th, I believe.
Yeah.
Baez into the left field corner. Gone! That's a grand slam for Baez. A run. Into the seats and left.
I had that good long at bat last time up, and this time it happens in a hurry. One swing of the bat, line drive, home run into the left field corner.
Things were going a lot better for the Cubs this week in 2016, weren't they, Anna?
Boy, weren't they. What a magical year for Cubbies and Cubs fans. And that was the grand slam hit by Javi Baez for a 12-2 victory over the Pirates, his career second. But even more notable about that game, Bob, it marked the Cubs' 100th win of the season. Before that, the last 100 win season was back in 1935. So you kind of got the sense that magic was in the air. And they were on their way to the World Series victory.
I've lost track. Baez is with Detroit now, Dave?
He's with the Tigers. Okay. Went to the Mets, then the Tigers.
I got to check my scorecard. Let's talk about Quaker Oats in Chicago. Anna?
Legendary food company, born here, 1901, Bob. Do you eat Quaker Oats? Are you a fan of the Quaker Oats?
I like their oatmeal.
Oatmeal, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like it, too. Still such a classic. It was the result of a lot of many mergers over the years. The Imperial Oat Mill merged with the American Cereal Company, renamed itself Quaker Oats, Bob. Star product, even back then, ready-to-eat oatmeal, but it was not an easy sell. Apparently, back in the early 1900s, oats was something you only really fed to horses. And so humans were like, what are they doing? Why are they marketing it? Well, so it took some marketing, and Quaker Oats, it turns out, was great at marketing. They put that Quaker on the package, symbol of purity, quality, and strength, and they got that round packaging they still have today, and made it super tasty, and there you go. It became a huge hit. Quaker Oats became the king of ready-to-eat cereals, too, including Cap'n Crunch and Life cereal, which again required some marketing to get people to eat it. Remember the old ads for a Life cereal with a little kid, Mikey?
Oh, might yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We have it.
Let's hear it.
What's this stuff? Some cereal. It's supposed to be good for you. Did you try it? I'm not going to try it. You try it. I'm not going to try it. Let's get Mikey. Yeah. He won't need it. He hates everything. He likes it! Hey, Mikey! Yeah.
When you bring Life home, don't tell the kids it's one of those nutritional cereals you've been trying to get them to eat. You're the only one who has to know.
He likes everything. And this is really interesting that, 1907, the company sales were like $20 million, and then 10 years later, $120 million. Wow.
Think about that at that time, too, you know, how early it was to have that kind of success. Their biggest failure, actually, Bob, came many, many years later when they acquired Snapple. Remember that whole thing? They were the Gatorade kings, and everybody, Gatorade was just exploding. And then for $1.6 billion in 1994, they bought Snapple, sold it at a huge loss a couple years later, and that didn't work out so well. But overall, Quaker's still doing pretty good.
And they got into the movie business, too, didn't they?
I love this story that they actually funded Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. They got together with big movie producers, and they said, well, we're going to fund this movie. And the whole idea was they would have a Willy Wonka chocolate bar that would debut with the movie, and sales would, you know, be through the roof. Unfortunately, the Willy Wonka chocolate bar didn't make it out of production quite well. It wasn't tasting so good, and it just didn't time out well with the movie.
Yeah.
But the movie, thank goodness they made the movie, because what an awesome film that is. But not so much for the chocolate bar.
Yeah, lots of marketing ideas over the years from Quaker. And talking about candy, I forgot that the turtle started here. What year was it?
It's 1916, Bob. Demet's Soda Fountain and Candy Store, right there on Madison Street, came up with something that still defines them to this day, 100 years later. They came up with the turtle. There were already these chocolate-covered pecans. That was big, apparently, back then. But they added the caramel, and they made them look like little turtles, and they named them that. And sure enough, that was a huge thing for Demet's. And they actually trademarked the name turtle. So when you buy the Fannie Mae ones, you know, they're pixies, mm-hmm. and they call them different things. But they own that name. They are the original. And I'd say all of them taste pretty good, though.
Yeah,
Huge fan of the turtle.
Yeah, the packaging is still pretty much the same as it was back in 1916, right?
It looks retro, too, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It looks so cool. And when you go back and look at the original, the pictures from way back in the day, still those stripes, the orange and gold, or the red and gold, mm-hmm. and white stripes, kind of the same thing.
Makes the turtle taste better. I've told this story before. When I was a kid, I used to hang out at the Eugene Field Park, and the field house had a candy machine. One of those old green vending machines, and mm-hmm. oftentimes Demet's turtles were in there. And one day, something went amok with the vending machine, and you could just pull the lever, and you'd get candy bars without putting your dime in.
Whoa!
Yeah, I think I ate about 20 packages of turtles that weekend.
Oh, that's awesome! What a great childhood memory. I love that.
Yeah, it was a great moment in the neighborhood. Thanks, Anna. We'll talk to you next Wednesday.
Sure thing, Bob.